All right, a few announcements. One, I'm supposed to announce that there is a Christmas open house Saturday, December 26th, from 1 to 4 at Bill and Rena's. You don't need to bring anything. Clothes, come dressed. No food or anything like that. That will be from 1 to 4 on Saturday, December the 26th. Everyone is invited. We still need a volunteer for the annual audit on January the 21st, or 23rd, at 3 p.m. We need to get that taken care of. And Bill has a sign-up sheet for 2010 for those who want to apply in that area. All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship and continue on here dealing with the ongoing subject here of the destruction of Nineveh, which this verse has been, to this point, the most graphic within the book in terms of the destruction being likened to that of an unfaithful prostitute who is publicly humiliated. And that figure will be expanded upon as we see in chapter 3. The idea here, it is fixed, it is finished, this is a done deal. God is the one who fixed it. The nation, the city, is stripped, she is carried away. And that forms the essential explanation of what it is that is fixed. And the attendant circumstance is introduced with the participle, her handmaids are moaning like the sound of doves, beating on their breasts. Again, the word breast, heart, the chest, the place where the heart is located. It's actually the Hebrew term heart. They've translated it as breasts. And again, while the emphasis here, no doubt, is on the female servants and slaves, and it may be that the coalition did not take any male prisoners in this deal. We don't know for sure. There isn't a lot of extra-biblical information on that. But one would expect certainly some male prisoners were taken as well, but the focus is on the females first and foremost here. And of course, most likely, the most desirable females, the females within the harem. As the palace falls, this is what is left for them to deal with. Though Nineveh was like a pool of water throughout her days. Again here, seeing the wow as introducing a concessive clause, now, and this is contrasted with the wow that follows, now they are taking flight or are fleeing. Stop, but no one turns back. And we're dealing with that phrase, the pool of water, which deals with the goods and people that had poured into the city, not because of their righteousness, but because of their rapacious nature in attacking other kingdoms and bringing all that wealth into Nineveh, and of course the forced labor, the slaves that would have built the city up, and essentially building the city on the backbone of other people's hard work. So again, point 40 is where we left off, I think. During the waters are now flowing out of the city. The pool of water, some have again suggested that this refers to a Ninevite peace that it enjoyed during the course of its history. And at some level, obviously, it did enjoy peace as the capital city, but the emphasis is really on the water flowing into it, and that it became a receptacle, a pool of water, for the goods and the people that came into it through the course of her history. So 41, the Hebrew phrase, meyemihi, from her days, literally means from the beginning of her days or throughout her lifetime. With a third-person pronoun here functioning as a possessive genitive. 42, the latter portion of verse 8 has generated some debate as to who is speaking. Some see the speaker as an Assyrian official, while others suggest that Nahum is speaking ironically. And 43, given what follows in verse 9, which are certainly not commands that came from within Nineveh. The commands are from God, who is speaking sarcastically. And again, you get into this issue of the destruction of a nation. Well, in this case, a city first, the capital city, but ultimately the nation. And God is to the point where there is no mercy for these people. And so there is a lot of taunt and sarcasm found within the book of Nineveh. as he challenges the Ninevites to do what they can to stop all this. As you saw, I introduced, for instance, in chapter 2, verse 1. Man the fortress, or watch the road, strengthen your back, summon all your strength. These are sarcastic commands because God knows that even if Nineveh does this, they're not going to survive this. God is taunting the city, and I believe he is taunting the city here. Stop. Well, nobody's going to turn back. Nobody's listening. And we'll see that again in chapter 3. Well, actually, later in chapter 2, you have the taunt introduced with, where is, verse 11, where is the den of the lions? And this is a taunt insinuating that the lion's den has been plundered now. And then the taunt, the Noamon taunt in verse 8 of chapter 3. Are you better than Noamon, the city of Thebes? Which was around the Nile. And he taunts them with that. Then you see in verse 12, the taunt of the fortifications are like fig trees with ripe fruit. When shaken, they fall into the eater's mouth. This is the ease with which Nineveh will be conquered. And then he continues to taunt them in verse 13, your people are women in your midst. Verse 14, draw for yourself water for the siege. Strengthen your fortifications. Go into the city and tread the mortar. Take hold of the brick mold. It won't matter. There the fire is going to consume you. You're going to be done. And he continues this taunt really all the way through verse 17. Your guardsmen are like the swarming locusts. Your marshals are like the hordes of grasshoppers settling in the stone walls. The sun rises and they flee. And the place where they are is not known. Your shepherds are sleeping. And so here we see God demonstrating his complete mercilessness toward this place. Again, you might see these things happening and you would have normal human compassion, but that has to be set aside at this point. So 44, although some versions, the NIV, the English Standard Version, and the Christian Standard Bible, supply the words they cry, the compressed speech is far more dramatic and effective as it stands. Adding words to it here, the design, and Nahum is very good at this, as we pointed out. I mean, when you read the introductions to this book, you read about Nahum's skill as a poet and his ability to handle things. But again, you see so much of this that you get in the Hebrew that you don't effectively get in some cases in the English translations. And particularly when they supply things, the brevity of this is designed to make it all the more emphatic. Nahum is brief for a purpose. And so sometimes he eliminates prepositions where you would normally expect them and just uses these compressed commands. 45, as the populace flees or is carried away captive, the reality is that no one heeds the two commands to stand still. And the word essentially means, it comes from the Cal imperative of Ahmad, means to stand. So the idea of stop is, you know, stand where you are. 46, the one thing that is certain is that none of the populace heeds the command. No one turns around to return to Nineveh. Well, in fact, if they managed to survive the initial onslaught, let's say they got away, would you go back? Well, one of the things you're going to find is that there's nothing to go back to. And those that are being carried away captive, they can't turn around and go back. It's not. They can just moan and beat their breasts and cry and bemoan the fact that their nation is no longer, or at least their city. But again, this is just a precursor to what will happen to the entire nation. Verse 9, plunder the silver, plunder the gold, for there is no limit to the treasure. Wealth from every kind of desirable object. These are Cal imperatives, of course, masculine plural being issued to the invading forces. Bazaz is the first one, B-A-Z-A-Z. this term is always associated with warfare and violence, and it indicates the taking of goods or persons by force. So plunder is a very good translation for this term. The invading military comes in and takes what they desire. Plunder the silver. Silver is kesef, K-E-S-E-P-H. And plunder, same verb again, bazaz, the gold, zahav, Z-A-H. A-B-H, the term for gold. There does not exist, generally translated in the New American Standard, there is not. It's the adverb, you have an adverb of existence, which is yesh, And then you have the adverb of non-existence, ayin.
A-Y-I-N.
I was always able to remember these because yes, there is, and no, there ain't. That was a little trick I learned in Hebrew class. So there does not exist. There is not. An end is ketse.
Q-E-T-S-E-S-E-H. Another way around.
An end or an extremity to the storehouse, literally. You've got the inseparable preposition lamed plus the definite article here plus tikuna.
T-E-K-H-U-N-A-H.
Tikuna means really a home or a seat, literally. In context here, it's the home or seat, the storehouse of the treasures. So the idea here, it's used by metonymy, the storehouse being used for what's in it, not just, you know, the storehouse itself, but what's contained inside it. And Nahum does this. I mean, this is one of the brilliant things you see about the way he writes. He uses metonymy. He uses simile, he uses metaphor, he uses alliteration, he uses assonance. He's got all these skills that he... there's even, again, a small part of an acrostic in this book. Not a complete one, but a part of one. So Nahum writes, obviously being led by the Holy Spirit, but demonstrating his own human intelligence and ability to put these things together. For there is no limit to the treasure, wealth from every kind of desirable object. Wealth is actually the masculine singular noun, kavod.
K-A-B-H-O-D-H.
Kavod really means literally weighty or heavy. When used of people, it means people that have a position of power or influence, and so they're dealt with as weighty. When used of material objects, it means that which is valuable, weighty as opposed to lightweight or insignificant. So wealth or riches, and they've translated it wealth here. Wealth from, preposition men plus the masculine singular noun construct of kol. Wealth from all or every. And then the feminine singular noun, they've tried every kind, is the way they've translated kol there. Of desirable objects is chemdah,
C-H-E-M-D-A-H.
Literally, that which is desirable, that which is pleasant, that which is precious, that which people look at and find satisfying. So that which they long for. Verse 10, she is emptied. Yes, she is desolate and waste. Hearts are melting. Knees knocking. Also anguish is in the whole body, and all their faces are grown pale. She is emptied is actually the feminine singular noun, only used one time here, of buka.
B-U-Q-A-H.
And this is the only time it's used, empty or emptiness. Empty and emptiness. What you have here, and you actually have here, what you have is a play on words, and you can kind of see, and if you can read the Hebrew, I don't know how many of you know Hebrew letters, but what you have is buka, then you have the next term, mabuka, then you have the next term, mabulaka. And he takes this word, this sound, and he builds on it as he goes. And it doesn't, again, it doesn't, I don't think, come across very well in the English. But she is emptied. Then you have another term that's only used one time, mabuka.
So you have a buka, which is that root. Then he takes that
and then expands on it. This would actually be probably a participle form of it. And then you have a wow plus the feminine singular noun, empty. And they've translated this, yes, she is empty and waste. Empty or emptiness. Empty. Emptiness, and then this last term, mabulaka,
M-E-B-U-L-L-A-K-A-H,
is a pu'al participle in form, and it appears to be related to the verb ba'kak, which was used in verse 2, meaning to devastate or lay waste. And so they have, and one of the ones, and I can't remember right now, I know one of the guys, here, they tried to portray the way Nahum was trying to write this, and so if you look down in your notes to verse point 18 here, he uses this wordplay, and the way we would probably do it in the English would be with three D's, destroyed, despoiled, and denuded, would be maybe one of the best ways to produce the assonance, the common sounds that he's using in here to convey what he's getting at. So yes, she is emptied. She is desolate and waste. Hearts are melting. Wow here, and they haven't translated it here, but you have a wow here, and lev, L-E-V-H, lev, the Hebrew term for heart, and then a niphal participle, a masculine singular of masas, M-A-S-A-S. Literally to melt or dissolve, the niphal participle, we would say being melted. Hearts are being melted. And of course, metaphorically, this is used as a figurative way of talking about the loss of courage, the complete demoralization of the populace. And these people are, you know, and really, you could almost do the three Ds, destroyed, despoiled, denuded, and now here, despondent would be kind of the idea here, the building on these forms to communicate what he's trying to get at. Depressed. Hearts are melting. Knees are knocking. Well, they lead off with the masculine singular noun here, a wow plus this word, peak. P-I-Q. Again, only used one time. There's a lot of hapaxes in this chapter. For whatever reason, Nahum chose a lot of unique forms to express this. This comes from the verb puke, which doesn't mean puke like we think of it, but to reel or stagger around. So the two knees, they translated here, are knocking. And again, the complete loss of courage, the abject fear that now grips the populace. Feminine dual noun, a barak. That means the two knees. And it's a dual again. The two knees are knocking. Also, anguish is in the whole body. A wow here plus the word kala, C-H-A-L-A-H. Kalkala, from the verb, again, comes to spin around in circles, hence to writhe in pain. They've translated the word anguish. Writhing in the whole body, in all the body. Inseparable preposition bait here, plus the masculine singular noun construct of coal, and then this word, math, anain. M-A-T-H-N-A-Y-I-M. That word means the middle of the body, the loins, the hips. Some will translate this in all the inner parts. The idea, of course, is where people feel anguish. and all their faces are grown pale. You have a wow here plus the common plural noun, apaneth, the word faces of all of them, literally. Then you follow that with the third masculine plural noun construct with the third masculine singular suffix. The faces of all of them. And one of the things you see here is the shift from the city as a whole, where she's dealt with in these feminines, to the masculine to deal with the individuals in the populace. So the all of them here would encompass everybody observing this. All their faces are grown pale. You have a kind of an unusual construction here that's a little bit, it was difficult to determine exactly what he's getting at, because you got the word kavets, Q-A-V-H-E-T-S, or A-T-S, I'm sorry, kavets, to gather or collect, and then you got the word here, pa-rur, which means literally redness. P-A-apostrophe-R-U-R. So when you have kavats here used with the word redness, the idea is either faces are getting red, they're flushing from excitement, or the red is gathering. That word kavats means to collect or to gather up stuff, to go around and pick it up. And the idea is the redness is gathering, you know, elsewhere, draining from their faces. And that's the way most of the interpreters have looked at this. The translators have the idea. And again, they're either flushed from excitement or their faces are pale. Given the context, it would seem that faces being pale would be the more what you would expect here. But again, the construction is difficult, and that is readily acknowledged. Point one, the previous two verses dealt with the results of the invasion. As the once proud and mighty Assyrians either flee in fear or are violated and led away into captivity. And again, we are not talking here about some insignificant nation who doesn't have a lengthy history. We're talking about a nation of people who were known far and wide throughout the ancient Near and Middle East for their history, which extended all the way back to the time of Nimrod, who founded this city. And the city has had an extensive history. And, of course, these people are feared, largely. Now they are no longer feared. Now things have changed. So the haughtiness, the mightiness, all these things drain away as they come face to face with the destroyer who has come up against them, the one scattering who has come up against them, the warrior king who is commanding the forces of destruction. Well, two, with the people fleeing, the army defeated, and the palace taken, the city is ready to suffer what the Assyrians had been inflicting upon others. Three, individuals and nations will reap what they sow. Just as Nineveh had sown violence, destruction, and plunder, it would now reap the same. This is one of the reasons, of course, for living by, quote, the golden rule. Do to others what you want them to do to you, because God keeps track of this. And God watches how you treat people. And God watches how nations treat people. And the way they treat people is the way they're going to be treated. Justice demands that this be so. And again, as we saw these parallels, the more I got into this, the more you cannot, to me, miss the parallels between Nineveh and the United States and the way we have conducted ourselves in our history, the way we have plundered and grown wealthy at the expense of other nations, as we have, again, furthered the goals of the military-industrial complex at the expense of other people's civil rights, at the expense of human rights, and we don't care. I mean, as long as we can afford tennis shoes, we don't care. We don't care where they're made. You know, there's always, from time to time, you'll get this outrage. You know, poor Kathy Lee Gifford, she was, you know, the butt of some of it. But do you think she was any more guilty than anybody else? No, she probably didn't even know what was going on. But yet there are people in positions of power that do. And so we move into countries, we plunder their wealth, we plunder the populace for our own selfish ends. To me, the parallels are obvious. Again, although Nineveh is never applied specifically as a name to the U.S., as I know Edom and Babylon are. So people are going to reap what they sow. This is what you're taught. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Not effectively. Now, people mock God all the time. But what that verse means is that he's not effectively mocked long term. You may mock God for a while and get away with it, but you're not going to get away with it forever. And so the idea is, this is one of the reasons, not the only reason exclusively, but one of the reasons why we would tend to treat people in grace as long as we can, until it just becomes impossible. We stay at peace with all people as much as it depends on us. And even then, when it depends on us, sometimes our norms and standards force us to go to war, because it's the right thing to do. And I mean, I'm talking about on a human level, interaction with other people. If you want war, I will try to grace you out as long as possible. But if you want war, I will fight. Do not be deceived. And God is the same way, of course. He desires peace with mankind. Of that, there is no secret. He does not desire the destruction of the wicked. He has granted a great reprieve to the Ninevites some 100 years earlier, 110. And yet, they do not take advantage of it long term. They return to their rapacious and destructive ways. The violence that they inflicted on other cultures now comes back on them. And this is why, of course, as we know, in many cases when we invade countries, they don't really have a chance. We're going to move in with far more military might than they have. And still, the idea is that God, that is one of the reasons for the complete destruction of the U.S. We've earned it. We deserve it. And I'm talking about the leadership and those in the positions of power, not positive believers. Well, 4, verse 9 begins with the commands of God to the invading armies to plunder the wealth that the Assyrians have concentrated in Nineveh. And 5, Nineveh was the repository of every kind of wealth during the 7th century B.C. 6, every Assyrian campaign that resulted in victory. And that was the vast majority of them during this time in history. Under these various kings, Tiglath-Pileser, Esarhaddon, Sennacherib, and Ashurbanipal, this was the height of the Assyrian power. And no one really effectively withstood them for long. They would try these allies and getting allies, making these political alliances and treaties in order to fight against Assyria, but in the long run, it didn't work. We saw that in one of the Old Testament passages where they tried to get one of the kings of Judah to enter a pact with them to fight against Assyria, and they wouldn't do it because he'd already been warned by the prophets, don't do this. So every Assyrian campaign that resulted in victory, which was most of them, also resulted in the plundering of every valuable item. This included gold, silver, precious stones, costly garments, expensive vessels, and anything else that was considered valuable. Various spices and the types of things that they could come out with. Anything that they thought was of any wealth, of any value they took. 7, in the ancient records, when the Assyrians boasted about the spoil they had taken from others, silver and gold always topped the list. Well, we wouldn't expect that to be unusual because that has been the nature of mankind. People have recognized for years gold is the most valuable thing just about you can find. Now, in some ways, in the last days, because of technology and some other things, platinum is up there. But for years, it wasn't worth very much. And we even know that some things like copper and all of that have become way more valuable because of the need for them now. But again, silver and gold is what do you tell your husband you want for Christmas, copper? I don't ever remember reading, anywhere that copper is a girl's best friend. So obviously diamonds, expensive stones, these types of things. Well, 8, as an example, after the fall of Noamon, Thebes, Ashurbanipal bragged that he took silver, gold, precious stones, the goods of his palace, all there was, brightly colored and linen garments, great horses, the people, male and female, 2 tall obelisks. I removed from their positions and carried them off to Assyria. Heavy plunder and countless, I carried away from Ni. Ni was the Assyrian term for Noamon there. 9, there are also reliefs of Assyrian scribes writing down the types and amounts of plunder that were taken from other cities. This became a full-time job after a successful campaign of just recording what was taken. And as we know, the Assyrians were great administrators, and they tended to keep pretty good records. Now, I'm not saying, again, that they never embellished or exaggerated. We know that they did. We also know that one of the things you read in these records, you never read about any setbacks or defeats or any of that. You don't read about the angel of the Lord killing 185,000 Assyrians in one night. It's conveniently left out. But does that mean that the other records do not have at least some kernel of truth and some accuracy to them? I think they do. I think they took a lot of plunder. So much so that here and in chapter 3, it says her prey at chapter 3, verse 1, her prey never departs. And the prey gets into the plunder, the stuff she took. Verse 1, woe to the bloody city, completely full of lies and pillage. And so I don't think there's any exaggeration in some level in the Assyrian records, because God tends to confirm this in his word. 10, the Babylonian chronicles describe the spoils taken from Nineveh by the Babylonians and the Medes in these terms, a great quantities of spoil from the city beyond counting they carried off. In 11, one should recognize that this is not simple exaggeration, but indicates that the plunder in the city, which once plundered the other nations of the world, was extensive in both quantity and value. This city was a very wealthy city by all standards. It was very well fortified. And again, all these things, the wealth and the fortifications, would tend to suggest to them that they were invincible. But they're not. They might think they are, but they're not. 12, one can simply read the records of the Assyrians that have been preserved, and he will find lists of spoils taken by the Assyrians during their military campaign. And you can check out that site if you are so inclined. 11, these commands to plunder the silver, plunder the gold, were obeyed so thoroughly that one of those involved in the excavation of Nineveh has commented that very little silver and gold has been found in the ruins of the city. And again, when you get into archaeological excavations of any area, of any place, there are going to be occasionally these great finds you come across. But not in the case of Assyria, not in the case of Nineveh. As they excavated this place, they're stunned at the lack of anything there of any real value. And in fact, again, as we pointed out, they didn't know for years even where Nineveh was. It was so thoroughly razed to the ground that people were not even aware of its location. So much so that, again, until much later in history, some 2,000 years later, they finally found it. So, 14, the Medes, Babylonians, and Scythians so completely stripped the city that there was literally nothing of value left in it. 15, Nahum employs a bit of hyperbole, again, another grammatical device designed, a literary device, to intentionally exaggerate the fact in order to prove a point. As he states, there is no limit to the treasure, which is designed to emphasize how massive the treasures were within the city. And you see this phrase, matter of fact, Nahum's a little bit fond of there does not exist a limit to, he uses it again in chapter, I have to go look, but I don't remember. But I know I've seen this phrase several times within the book, that there does not exist a limit or an end to certain things. So here, the final point, of point 16 here, the final part of the verse provides a synopsis of the items that were found within the city, which included any type of item that men would deem to be valuable. And that varies, again, at some level from person to person. Now, like, say, a person who's a cook, they're going to be really fond of exploiting the spices and all those things they find, which were deemed to be quite valuable in ancient cultures because they weren't readily available. You couldn't go down to the store and buy a little deal of cinnamon. You had to have raw cinnamon, essentially. What one would deem valuable, some people are clothes horses. They're going to be really excited about, oh my God, it's like a department store here, only it's all free. So you get to go to Macy's and just take anything you want. How's that? Could you live with that for a day? Or wherever you like to shop. And it would have been top dollar stuff too. They're not going to plunder and hoard up a bunch of junk. They've got enough military and enough sense to know that they're only going to take the best of the best. So here, 17, in light of the fact that Nahum suffered the loss of its military, its citizens had fled or been taken captive, Nahum provides the logical description of the city after it had been taken. And 18, in verse 10, Nahum uses a bit of wordplay that is not easy to reproduce in English. But Patterson has suggested the translation of destroyed, despoiled, and denuded. 19 other versions have attempted to reproduce the assonance, the identity or similarity in sound between the vowels in neighboring words. Alliteration, which is the repetition of the initial consonant sounds of neighboring words, and paronomasia. A pun that's using words similar in sound for the point of making a point, for the effect of it. Of the three similar sounding Hebrew words, abuka, mabuka, mabulaka. And again, you would not necessarily pick up on the sounds of this in the English at all. But it's real clear when you look at the Hebrew and you're looking at the roots of these words, you realize they all come from the same root. 20, the final result is that Nineveh has become empty of inhabitants and of anything of value. The conquered city is personified as a desolate woman. Again, a figure that is applied to prophetic Babylon, the United States, following her destruction. in Isaiah 47:1. And again, the predominant chapters that deal in the Old Testament with prophetic Babylon. There are many references to Babylon throughout the Bible. But one must make distinctions between ancient Babylon, the city itself, the reality, the real city Babylon, and then the way Babylon is used, religious Babylon, is another whole entire structure, and then political or prophetic Babylon. And one has to keep in view what's in view. But again, you can't do this necessarily by just looking at the term. You have to look at overall context. You have to ask yourself, have these prophecies, say towards Babylon, been fulfilled? Are they unfulfilled? And if they are fulfilled, is there any evidence of it? And so you get into situations, for instance, like with prophetic Babylon, where you see it used of being completely devoid of inhabitants and uninhabitable, in fact. Forever uninhabitable. And that can't be fulfilled over there in the Middle East, because that is going to be an impossibility. You've got lots of people in and around ancient Babylon still. So one, we know it hasn't happened, and two, that section of the world cannot be that devastated, ever. Because if it is, essentially, if Babylon was struck with a nuclear warhead, even just one or two, and we're not talking about that when we're talking about the destruction of prophetic Babylon. We're talking about massive amounts of these things. The entire Middle East would be uninhabitable. I mean, you couldn't have anything over there. Well, Isaiah 47:1, again, when you're dealing with prophetic Babylon, the key passages are Isaiah 13, 21, and 47, and Jeremiah 50 and 51, and Revelation 18. Six passages that deal specifically with the destruction of the U.S. So come and sit down in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit down on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans. For you will no longer be called tender and delicate. And that is essentially, of course, a desolated woman, the same sort of figure, is applied to the destruction of the U.S. 21, Isaiah uses a similar type of wordplay, which may indicate that there was either a literary relationship between the two prophets, or that Nahum was simply familiar with Isaiah's writings, and I lean towards that because I think Nahum wrote slightly after Isaiah did. I don't know that they were contemporaries. Isaiah 24:1. And Isaiah uses this sort of similar wordplay in the Hebrew, and you can see it a little bit in the English. The Lord lays the earth waste, devastates it, distorts its surface, and scatters its inhabitants. And you have kind of a similar bit of wordplay. It's not identical to Nahum, but certainly I would think that Nahum was well aware of Isaiah's writings. 22, Nahum now moves to a description of the physical reaction of the Ninevites to the terrifying events that were befalling them. 23, the reality and gravity of the situation was such that even the strongest person could not help but be sick to death of what he was seeing. I mean, to survey this site, the all of it, from the beginning stages of the initial attack, the onslaught, the piles, the mounds of dead bodies outside the cities that literally impeded the progress of the soldiers moving toward it. And then you get into the city, the destruction of the city, the inhabitants being slaughtered before your very eyes. The massive amounts of blood and guts and gore was incomprehensible. And again, we're talking about a city probably with a population, you know, at this time, another 100 years later, it could have been approaching 750,000. And again, while a few of them would have got away, no doubt there were the lucky ones, call them lucky, who managed to survive and somehow avoid the onslaught. And I would assume those likely had to be the ones living on the outer environs, not the ones directly within the city. Likely none of them escaped. I don't see any reason they would have. But those on the outside that managed to make it away, I don't think there would have been many of them. But then when you saw all of this unfolding before your eyes, if you were there and you lived through it all, and you saw your family slaughtered right before your eyes, mercilessly, just the same kind of merciless slaughter that your people had engaged in for years. I mean, you would kind of have to know, I would think, even your conscience, if you're observing this, while it might make you sick, your conscience would say, you know, unfortunately, we deserve this. Now, they won't think that way necessarily, but a believer might. Well, 24, Nahum describes the abject terror of anyone that was fortunate enough, or unfortunate as the case may be, to witness the death, destruction, and mayhem that was being inflicted on the city and its inhabitants. He begins with a metaphor, point 25, and he does this pretty regularly. He uses simile and metaphor a lot in these writings because he likens Nahum to several different things. And then with the metaphor here, here he uses the body metaphor to describe her. Nahum uses, he begins with a metaphor, a word or phrase that ordinarily designates one thing that is used to designate another. Which is designed to portray the internal effect of the ruin on Nineveh on those that were observing it. 26, the fact that hearts are melting is a picturesque way of describing the complete loss of courage by the surviving Ninevites. I mean, and we're talking about a loss of courage so complete that this makes a depression so deep that Zoloft won't help it. Paxil won't help it. You're not going to be able to take enough antidepressants to get over this. Not that they didn't have any. 27, it is also used of in the Old Testament, rather, to describe the loss of desire to defend oneself, one's city or one's nation. It denotes the complete loss of resistance. Joshua 2:11, we see this at the time of the conquest. Again, Rahab the harlot, the prostitute, was the only positive volition there, and yet she can articulate the truth very well. When we heard it, and what did they hear about? They heard what they did to the two kings of the Amorites. Well, they heard about the Egyptian exodus, which was an event, of course, which we pointed out, that God used to evangelize the entire known world at that time. Word of this spread. They didn't have Pony Express or mail or any of that. They certainly weren't texting each other. But the word spread, and the word spread quickly. What has happened to the Egyptians? Have you heard? And the word spread that the Israelites apparently had decimated Egypt as they left the place. And Egypt had become a decimation. And then when they got to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, we heard what you did to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. When we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in the heaven above and on earth beneath. And so she makes a deal with him. Smart. Hey, let's make a deal. I know what's going to happen, and I don't want to die. And so her positive volition is rewarded. She deals kindly with them, and they deal kindly with her. They keep their word. Also, chapter 5, verse 1, same book, Joshua. And it came about when all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west. Now, they had conquered the kings on the other side of the Jordan on the east. And all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard how the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan before the sons of Israel until they crossed, that their hearts melted. And there was no spirit in them any longer because of the sons of Israel. I mean, can you imagine that? This army's advancing on you, and you know it. And you know God's for them, and you know that you don't have a snowball's chance. And literally hell will freeze over before you'll get a victory. And you know all this. And you see it coming and you can do absolutely nothing to stop it. Well, that would be demoralizing to the maximum. Isaiah 13:7. Again, in one of the passages that relate to prophetic Babylon. And can you imagine? And again, and I remember they did this, and this had to be back, God, this had to be in the early 80s that I saw this. And it was just not too long after the show Nightline had started. And I remember them running a segment on what happens in an all-out nuclear strike. And it was ironic, because at that time I was not on doctrine. I didn't know anything about what was going to happen. But essentially, from the time of the Soviet strike, from the time they pushed the button, we call it, from the time they launch, you have something like 30 or 32 minutes before impact. Because they are not only going to launch, and some will probably hit quicker than that now. Because the more, even the technology has improved in the last 25 years, and you now have these nuclear submarines capable of carrying multiple warheads, MIRVs, on their submarines. And the submarines do not lie only around Russia, trust me, just as our submarines do not lie only around the United States. And they are all over the world, monitoring and doing whatever it is they do. And so you have something like 30 to 32 minutes, and because of the nature of the beast at that time, I don't know if technology's improved or not. I haven't seen anything that's suggesting to me that it has. But it took something like 27 minutes for them to determine if the attack is real or if it's a hoax. So essentially, you got 5 minutes. And the last 5 minutes of your life, the word's going to go out. No doubt, it may go out quickly, it may go out before then, that the Soviets have launched an all-out nuclear strike. And that warheads are coming in, make your preparations. Well, your only preparation is to bend over and kiss your butt goodbye, because that's all you can do. What are you going to do in 30 minutes? Even if you had the full 30 minutes, even if you knew an hour before they did it, what are you going to do? And the answer is you can't do anything. You can't get anywhere that's safe. I'll bet you money MacDill's targeted. Want to bet? I bet all the major population centers are targeted. So Tampa. So how's Sarasota going to fare in this? Not too well. So you might be able to survive a little. I don't know. The peninsula's pretty thin, though. I mean, if you're out in the middle of Okeechobee, which they're probably not going to strike there. You know, they're not interested in the alligator and the gar. Wherever you live, I mean, you know, if you live, the best you could live would be somewhere in, you know, remote Montana or something, where there's no population centers even around you. But even then, what's going to be left? And the answer is nothing. So as we know here, this is, what are you going to do? Well, when this happens, when the word goes out, and no doubt it goes out over the airwaves before the first EMP hits and takes out all communications. The first thing that will happen is they'll fire off an electromagnetic pulse above in the atmosphere that will take out all the communications. So and once that happens, it won't matter. Your TV's going to go dead. Your radio's going to go dead. Nothing's going to work. You won't be texting. I mean, we won't be here, but the people that are here. Their computers are going dead. And so suddenly you've got no electricity, you've got no power, you've got nothing. You're sitting there in darkness waiting and wondering what's going to happen. Well, it won't take long to find out. That is the good thing, I guess. Well, this is how he describes this. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. And why he says near in verse 6 is because this happens just prior to the beginning of the day of the Lord. This happens just prior to the middle of Daniel's 70th week. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will fall limp. Every man's heart will melt. They will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look at one another in astonishment. Their faces, and the Americans, the proud Americans, will look at one another and say, we never believed this could happen. We never bought into it. And yet if you do any research of any kind on the U.S.-Soviet relations over the years, and even current Soviet activities, the fact is, we're dismantling warheads and they're building more. The fact is, we have given up the idea of the, you know, the doctrine that we used to embrace called MAD. It's a good name for it. Because it's mad to think it's going to happen. Mutually assured destruction. This is our doctrine that we hold to. This is what we think are going to save us. Because the Soviets know, if we strike them, they will destroy us too. No, we won't. That's the whole point of the prophecy. We don't even fire a shot back in retaliation. Why? Because the president is in the White House as a woman wetting himself. And that's what's going to happen. Or maybe there'll be a literal woman in the White House by then. Who knows? But the reality is, we're not prepared for this. And when it does happen, they're just going to stand around staring at each other. We never thought this could happen to us. And then they will find out, yes, just like Nineveh, it did. And Ezekiel 21:15, the last one here. Uh, As he commands the prophet, here, clap your hands together, verse 14, and let the sword be doubled the third time. In other words, whatever destructions have happened in the previous two, let's double it now. That all their hearts may melt, and many fall at their gates. I have given the glittering sword. It is made for striking like lightning. It is wrapped up in readiness for slaughter. And once again, this begins to come to pass. There's no averting it. There's no averting it for Nineveh. There's no averting it for Babylon. There's no averting it for any nation that God's against. And ironically enough, of course, after the Soviets have destroyed us, they will move into the Middle East and God will destroy them on the mountains of Israel. If I remember right, 5 out of 6 of them fall. And so people have wondered for years, why would the Soviets move into the Middle East with conventional warfare when they could just nuke the place and take it over? Well, the fact is they won't have any nukes left. They fire off every one of them at us. Well, 28, the overt effect of the abject fear and distress causes a weakness or trembling in the knees. And this idiom is designed to convey the idea of a powerful and debilitating fear. And that is what the Ninevites have to look forward to. A powerful, debilitating fear as God readies himself to take them out. All right, well, our time is gone, so we will stop there and be ready to continue here on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the opportunity of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.